Next topic is all about real cash flows. And it goes to show that even when we can measure things, accounting can get extremely complicated. And Andrea is going to explain us how we're going to shape order in insurance, accounting for insurance contracts.
Thank you, Hans. Okay, so we've got agenda paper 2, which looks like quite a long slide deck, but hopefully we can keep it interactive and you can interrupt me as we go on and share your views or ask questions or whatever you want to say. I've started with a little bit of background to our project, and I think most of you have heard me give this spiel fairly recently, so I won't spend an awful lot of time on it. But really just to say that we think there's an urgent need to finalise a new standard on insurance contracts. The existing situation is IFRS 4, which had always been intended to be an interim standard. It permits a wide continuation of a wide variety of accounting, which we think doesn't help with comparability and transparency. And as a result, we wanted to try and finalise our standard as expeditiously as possible. We see the latest exposure draft, which we published in June 2013, as very much a next step along our process towards that standard. Since our original discussion paper in 2007 through our last exposure draft in 2010, we've been listening and responding to the comment letters and the outreach we've done on those proposals, and we've made some changes which I've grouped into three sorts of categories. The simplest is we provided additional clarification and guidance. We've also made some practical accommodations where we think we've got the right conceptual answer, but we think that there are possibly easier ways to achieve some of the things that the standards sought to do. And we've also changed how we represent some aspects of the features of insurance contracts. And it's really on this last category that the new exposure draft is focused. So we see this as very much building on the previous consultations, and we're seeking feedback only on the changes to the previous proposals and targeting our exposure draft on those changes. Because of that, we're also looking very closely at the operational and reporting complexity, not just of the proposals we're targeting, but also of the standard as a whole, because we think that this is a good opportunity to take a final sense check of the proposals before we finalise the standard. Slide 3 is a somewhat busy slide, which tries to list some of the main issues that we've had with insurance contracts accounting in the past. And, you know, obviously we think we have a better answer now. That's something that is a matter of debate and has been a matter of fairly extensive debate over the years. But I think really the most important thing to say about all of these issues and the way we propose to deal with them is that in any case we're going to have a much bigger comparability between the accounting for different insurance contracts and between insurance contracts and other sorts of transactions. And I think that ultimate goal is one that's well worth bearing in mind as we go through the rest of the process. Slide 4 is a reminder that our proposals affect not insurance companies, as is often the case for insurance type accounting, but any entity that issues any type of insurance contract. So it's a contract-based standard, not an entity-specific standard. And that will be a significant change in many jurisdictions. So because of that, we've also included a number of other contracts that we think share many features with insurance contracts, in particular these investment contracts that contain discretionary participation features. And the thinking there is that those have the same very long duration, same amount of uncertainty as insurance contracts. IFRS 9 does not adequately deal with those contracts, and we've had a lot of practice questions about it, and so we think that since we have this model which deals with those features, we should apply it to those contracts as well. Hans mentioned how complex and difficult all this insurance accounting is, and for that reason we've decided to exclude from the scope some contracts that do meet the definition of an insurance contract. That would be the third party type product warranties and the fixed fee service contracts, which many people are fairly comfortable can be dealt with adequately using other IFRSs. And so as standard setters, I guess, part of our call for help is to help bring that scoping into people's minds and make sure that we have reached a good place for that scope and that we've drawn the line in a way that suitably balances our twin objectives of consistent accounting for insurance contracts with not making things too difficult for fairly straightforward contracts. Because we're trying to get the same principles for all types of insurance contracts, then I think what that means really is that the impact of our proposals will largely depend on what people are doing today for the different types of contracts, and the impact will be different for different types of contracts. So the debate has largely been focused around life contracts, and it's true that those would get the biggest impact from our proposals. But that's not to say that the non-life contracts won't be affected. And in fact, many of the changes we've made since 2010 have had perhaps a bigger impact on the non-life contracts than many had assumed. And people are becoming aware of that, and we're hearing that in our feedback. So slides 6 and 7 deal with the crux of our proposals, and we're really focusing on our current measurement of the insurance contract liability, and all the proposals from the exposure draft really flow from that starting point. We've said it has two components. We have, and both of these are obligations that the insurer has when it writes a contract. One is an obligation to pay cash, and we measure that using fulfillment cash flows, using a discounted, risk-adjusted measure of the full range of possible outcomes. We've also got our contractual service margin, which anchors the measurement of the liability to the premium at inception and reflects the expected contract profit, the expected profit that the entity will earn from providing services under the contract. Our 2010 proposals were criticised for spending too much focus on the measurement and not enough focus on what happens in the statement of comprehensive income. So on slide 7, I've put down a slide which shows how the information from the measurement of the insurance liability flows through to the statement of comprehensive income. And what you see there is the way that the different components of the measurements, the way you can think about the different components of the measurement, impact different line items in the statement of comprehensive income in different ways. And these two features about our revised proposals, which are the most different. On the first, on the top half of the statement of comprehensive income, we have moved from a net margin type presentation to a more traditional revenue minus expenses equals profit type presentation. And we think that that will improve the comparability within insurance contracts between life and non-life, for example, but also with other industries. And it will bring the revenue reported, the top line of insurance contracts, more consistent with other contracts with customers. The second change on the statement of comprehensive income is in the bottom half, where we talk about the effective discount rate changes on the insurance liability. And what this does is we are segregating the change in total comprehensive income into a component that represents like an amortized cost type view of the time value of money in the profit or loss, and the effective discount rate changes in other comprehensive income. And we will come to that in a little bit more detail as well. Measurement and presentation are, of course, only part of the story, and we are not focusing on disclosures in this exposure draft because they were generally well accepted. I think it's fair to say that the disclosure package is a heavy one, but I think we're also fairly convinced that we need that extensive disclosure package because of the number of judgments and the subjectivity of some of the estimates that go into an insurance contract. And so we are focusing our disclosures in the standards of IFRS 7 way on the amounts that are reported in the financial statements, the judgments that go into determining those amounts, and the risks facing the entity. So as I mentioned, we are seeking feedback on targeted aspects, and I've grouped them into measurement type changes, presentation changes, which I've already outlined, and transition, which was perhaps one of the most contentious issues in our 2010 proposals. And we will go through each of these in turn, and I'll explain a little bit more detail. Apart from the actual issues that the board is targeting in its exposure draft, we're quite keen to take this opportunity to look at the balance between the benefits of the information we're providing and the complexity of the problem of the proposals as a whole. And that complexity has two parts that we need to consider. One is the operational complexity, and I think we're all in a fairly good position to understand and hear about the operational complexity because preparers are fairly used to telling us about what they expect their costs are going to be. But I think the more important one in some ways is the understanding, the complexity of understanding more complex information. And that's actually obviously quite a lot more difficult to assess because people don't have this information today, so they are less well placed to be able to tell us how they understand it and what usefulness they could put to information that they don't have already. And I think I would characterise the balance between benefits and complexity as almost a trade-off, because I think you've got something we've defined as being different because it contains insurance risk, but you have many different products which have insurance risk. And it's a question really of how closely you track those different products and how much you track it exactly at the granularity of each individual product, which creates the complexity by having lots of different models against perhaps a broader brush which perhaps doesn't track an individual contract as well as it might have done in the past, but overall gives a better picture of what goes on for an insurance contract as a whole. So moving on to the targeted issues, and the first question, and I'm going to stop after a bit and ask you what your views are on this, deals with the reporting of the changes in cash flows relating to future insurance coverage. So we have a contractual service margin at inception, and that represents the expected contract profit at the beginning of the contract. And the question really we're trying to address here is, when you have a change in the estimate of the cash flows, which means that your estimate of that contract profit changes, then when do you want to see it reported? Do you want to see it reported in the period of the change, even though this relates to the future, because you know bad news is coming, and therefore you want to see it all now? Or do you say, well, that change is because we're going to be providing service in the future that relates to that future service, and so the time that we want to see it is as we provide that service? And I would tend to characterise that as a sort of financial instruments, fair value kind of type point of view, which is what we proposed in 2010, versus a more revenue recognition type view, which is where we are in 2013. And slide 13 illustrates that difference. What it doesn't illustrate is the balance sheet impact. In fact, some of our latest slide decks do illustrate the balance sheet impact because some have commented on that. And while this pattern of profit, I think from our outreach so far, makes a lot of intuitive sense to a lot of people, it needs to be balanced with the fact that the liability doesn't move if you do this because you offset the cash flows against part of the liability. And so you don't see a spike in the liability when there's a large amount of bad news. And some people are also concerned with that. So I think in terms of what we've heard on it so far, we've had general acceptance of the concept of unlocking residual margin, as we call this, and there's been a number of more sort of detailed comments as well, and detailed questions about how we might tweak that general principle. But we have heard some objections from, say, perhaps some regulators, some emerging economies where there are concerns about tracking information, and some others as well. So on slide 14, I put down the pros and cons of the two proposals, and I guess my question to you is what your view is and whether you have any comments to make on this proposal.
Okay. Well, of course, since it's very rare that we have a fellow Hans at the table, I'm going to give him the floor first.
Well, maybe the similarity is also the passport. I'm Dutch as well. So, and not all of us are called Hans.
Not anymore.
Okay, moving to the question Andrea put on the table. EFRAG has issued a draft comment letter in the beginning of August, and this is one of the issues we of course address. We are sympathetic, we concur with how it's expressed on slide 6, contractual service margin represent expected contract profit. We also concur from that point of view with the unlocking mechanism. However, we think that if it is expected future profit, you should make sure it does meet that content. And our main concern is that if you look at slide 7, that the change in the risk margin is not adjusted on the contractual service margin, but in the P&L, that's where we have some concerns. We've read the basis for conclusion, which argues, yeah, it's too difficult. Our insurance accounting working group does not share that view, but okay. It's only us. So it's one of the topics for the field testing which is going on over the last few months, and where we get the first input in the presence of ISB staff. Andrea is one of the persons coming to Brussels tomorrow, where we get the first input from our field test participants whether or not it is as difficult as stated in the basis for conclusion. Unless we are convinced for the opposite, we think it's doable, and we think then an adjustment in the risk margin, like the other adjustments, if it deals with the future, should be on a contractual service margin. If it's the past, same as cash flows, then it's P&O.
Roger?
Well, I entirely agree with Hans, that we think a locking the margin to take account of future changes in the profitability is consistent with other IFRS standards. For example, long-term contracts, just the general revenue recognition standards. But we also agree that there's no conceptual basis for not taking changes in the risk margin there as well. So we entirely agree.
Kim?
I'll keep it short and sweet. Agree with Hans and with Roger as well. Also think that the risk adjustment needs to also be unlocked.
Kevin?
Yes, we support unlocking the CSM, and our industry, like Justice Hans has indicated, can't quite see why it is as difficult as the ISB expected, so they would want to do an allocation.
First, let me just take a minute to describe the process briefly that we're going through in Canada. Because of the importance of this industry in Canada, the Accounting Standards Board has formed an insurance accounting task force. It's comprised of preparers, both life and property and casualty. Both large and smaller preparers are represented by a rep from the association. We have actuaries, we have audit firms, and we have users. So we formed this group to help inform the Accounting Standards Board of the views of the stakeholders in Canada. And this particular issue, we have not been able to settle on a consensus view yet. What I can tell you is it is not split between life and P&C. So we have life and P&C taking views within their own industry. It is not split between preparers, auditors, or actuaries. The only thing they can agree on thus far is that it will be operationally complex. So more to come from us on this particular question.
So they do think it's difficult.
They do.
Yeah.
And that's interesting to me, and I'm trying to understand it better, because my going-in view is that because of the current Canadian practices, they're well along the way in terms of their practices, in terms of they should be able to deal with the complexity. So we're trying to pull back the layer of that onion to understand more about what they believe will be driving the complexity on this.
I would be quite interested in that as well, because I think if you were to do a fully retrospective unlocking of the margin, then I agree there would be quite a lot of tracking, quite a lot of information at a very granular level that's required. But because we require a prospective unlocking, we thought that that would reduce a lot of the complexity and the need for that, so that would be interesting to know.
So we're going to continue to probe that with Andrea, and since you dial into most of those calls, you'll be able to hear that.
Anna?
Yes, we support the unlocking and also what Hans has said about the adjustment of the risk.
I think it's time we give the floor to somebody who likes to lock.
Well, today in the U.S. GAAP, we lock the measurement of the liability, which in essence causes the P&L to act like your unlocking approach. One of the reasons why our stakeholders asked us to get involved is they felt that, at least for long duration, it was important to have more of a current measurement. Now, I recognize the approach that the ISB has come. While the total liability stays the same when you unlock, the components of the liability do vary. The FASB, as we know, went with a locking of the margin that results in a more current measure of the liability and flows to the P&L. The feedback we've gotten, at least from one major stakeholder group related to life insurance, is that they would prefer your approach, which would be to unlock the margin, which would get back to the same P&L they have today, which would be inconsistent with what people had told us to get into the project to begin with.
Okay.
Before going to the contractual service margin, I would like to start with something missing today's paper. which is treatment of like mirroring. We found the proposal of mirroring is quite difficult to understand. The scope of underlying items seems vague. It includes
I understand.
It's the next question.
Next question. Forget about. Okay, what I want to say is too vague. So, regarding unlock or lock of margin, at this point, we are in the process of making decision. We need to compare more about FASB model and ISB's model. So currently, majority of our constituents favor the unlock, but we need to see more the reasoning in the basis for conclusion. And the things we don't know well between the U.S. and the ISB is whether they have a different conclusion based on one factor or one circumstances, or based on different facts or circumstances. For example, somebody said in the United States, risk adjustment or risk margin is a big part of margin, but compared to that, ISB thinks mainly about already it's separated, but contractual service margin is much larger than the risk adjustment. So I don't know whether they see the same fact or not.
Bing?
Yeah. Our situation is the insurance companies are generally support the proposal in the new ED, but they are concerned. There is a big concern from them. It's they say the tracking cost is one problem. Another challenge is the concerns whether the quality of supervision as well as the quality of actuary can provide sound support to the application of this part of the proposal. And this is from the perspective of insurance companies, and from users, so far there's not clear observation by us. We hope to explore more jointly with the work team in two weeks in Shanghai.
Thank you.
Oh, Clem, sorry.
Our constituents in our jurisdiction actually expressed concern about, you know, the model proposed. Is it really appropriate to force the insurers to apply OCI or use the contractual service margin as buffer when in fact they don't manage their product in that way? I think that's one of the main concerns raised. And another sort of concern is about, you know, the complexity of the model. It is looked at maybe it's more straightforward and easier to explain even recognition through income statement, although this may result in volatility in earning.
Andrea?
Okay, thank you. So I guess there's a sort of general support here, though I think some places the views are not yet formed, and there's a question about how this actually relates into how companies manage their products today. Let's move on to the second issue, which is our second measurement issue, which I think Iko had already alluded to. The question we're trying to solve for here, the issue we're trying to fix, is that in some cases you have a contract where there is no possibility of economic mismatch between the cash flows you pay to the policyholder and the underlying assets that are held by the insurer. And we think that that situation occurs when two conditions are met. The first is that there is some kind of link, contractual link, by which we mean, as we normally mean under IFRS, terms implied in the contract by regulation and law. And that link needs to exist for there to be no possibility of economic mismatch. And the other condition is that the entity is required to hold the underlying items. And this draws a distinction from what I tend to think of as traditional unit-linked type contracts versus traditional index-linked type contracts, for example, whereas in the unit-linked, you have to hold the assets, and so there's no possibility of an economic mismatch. In an index-linked contract, you don't have to hold the assets, and although you may choose to hold the assets, that's an economic decision the entity has taken. And so we're drawing a line right in the middle, which I understand to be a challenge for many, many commentators. So, but in, given that we have the situation where there can be no possibility of an economic mismatch between the cash flows of the contract and the underlying items, how do we want to portray the fact? Because when you have assets that will be measured using a mix of measurement attributes, because they're all measured under either financial instruments or investment property or other IFRSs, then you are at quite a large risk of having an accounting mismatch. So how do we deal with that fact? And what we've said in our proposals is that when these limited conditions apply, when you meet these criteria, we will allow you to set the amount of the liability as equal to the carrying amount of the assets. And this will completely eliminate accounting mismatch, and we think that that's justified because we know there's no economic mismatch. However, if an economics mismatch is possible, we think that better information is given by reporting, you know, the full changes and any economic mismatch, accepting that there may also be some accounting mismatch there as well. So in terms of what we've heard on this proposal, I think the general gist of the feedback is that this is a really good idea, except when you actually try and apply it, at which point it becomes a really bad idea. So I think this is going to be a challenge faced by the board, really. And there's a number of issues. First is one of scope. Most people do not see the distinction I outlined between an index-linked and a unit-linked contract. Or they think that there might be a distinction in some cases, but not in all. So it's drawing that line. That's one question. Another is actually, how do you do this? What do we actually mean? This requires us to take part of the liability and measure it using one measurement basis and another part of the liability and measure it on another basis. And we have always said it is difficult to separate cash flows within an insurance contract, so why do we suddenly think we can do it now? That's another question that's thrown at us. There's also a question of what happens to options and guarantees, because one of the proposals the board has is that for these contracts, any option and guarantee type cash flows will go to profit or loss, which we saw almost as the price for having a cost-based measure of part of the liability. Does that make sense? If you have no mirrored cash flows in a contract that is eligible for mirroring, you might have a different measurement compared to a contract which has no mirrored cash flows because it wasn't eligible, and did that make an awful lot of sense? We're also hearing questions about, I think I mentioned the scope about how wide or narrow. We're also hearing, I think there's some disagreement about whether mirroring is effectively doomed because there's no way of splitting this at all, or whether it's just that we've drawn the wrong line and we could make it operational by making some changes as well. So I would say that this is by far the biggest area of focus in the outreach that I've done so far. It causes the most comments, it causes a lot of lack of clarity. People don't understand what it means, and I think at the moment we're still seeing people trying to work out what to do, but never mind whether or not they like it. And so I think that's an ongoing process that we are working on at the moment.
Roger?
Well, I had the pleasure of attending a very good session at IFAS with Andrea, and we went through this in some detail then, so I won't go through the same detail again. I do have substantial concerns with the current mirroring model because of the complexity that Andrea has already mentioned, the fact that economically identical situations can be accounted for very differently. One thing I know we're going to get onto later, but I think I need to raise now, is this question of OCI. I think OCI may fit some business models or these ways of running insurance businesses.
it doesn't fit others. And you can have a situation where a company is completely matched, but because they can't buy bonds, for example, for a long enough duration, they might buy a swap option or whatever going further out, and you end up with a sort of pseudo volatility going through the income statement, even though they've actually entirely matched their future cash flows, or at least their exposures. So I think, although in principle this sounds good, I think it doesn't work in practice. And I do think we need to look at an OCI through, a fair value through P&L account option for both liabilities and assets. I don't know why the board would be against that, because that's obviously the most transparent way of doing it, and it actually matches the way that many insurance companies, not just in the UK, actually run their business.
I think when we have mirroring applying, then the problem you identify doesn't apply, because you would mirror in the presentation as well as in the measurements. I think it would be addressed for the ones which would fall within the scope of mirroring. I think the ones that don't fall within the scope of mirroring, we do have the problem, and I'm sure we'll come on to some of those reasons when we talk about the OCI proposals as well.
Hans?
Yeah, I think the first comment I should make is that EFRAG has noted with pleasure the attempts to address a very important issue, the accounting mismatch. Consistently, that has been EFRAG's position in its comment letter in the earlier phases, try to address accounting mismatches if there is no or only limited economics mismatch. And the principle of mirroring can help a lot in that respect. But our concerns are the scoping. Yeah, the example Andrea gave about index linked versus unit linked, that has been on the table in other discussions as well. But suppose there's not this requirement to actually buy these underlying items, but the company does, then yeah, you can say it's an economically different situation. Well, we're not so sure about that, because also for those contracts, the investment returns and risk are still passed on to the policyholder. So is it really that different? We have concern not about the linkage, but about the second condition, the company should actually hold those assets. Another concern is that on the liability side, you will have two different measurement bases. One, let's say, amortized cost, and the other one is current value. And the arguments we read is that, yeah, but if you start from the liabilities, you might have a problem that there could be some assets which are not eligible for fair value, or even are not recognized. Perhaps there are a few contracts around where that can happen. But one of the things we had in discussion in a meeting a few weeks ago in Brussels is, do you develop global accounting standards for 90, 95 or 98% of the contracts in the world? How far do you want to go to stretch it to accommodate everything? And we, for that reason, don't buy in to that argument.
So, sorry, what do you think is a much smaller problem than we think it is?
Well, some examples are given in the basis for conclusion that if you would have current measurement for the liability as a starting point, and you try to address the accounting mismatch in the balance sheet, that would drive you to fair value the underlying or linked assets as well. Now, in some existing standards, that's not possible, that's not allowed. And there are some proposals to change some of them, to align it, but an example which has been given is a deferred tax asset. Well, that's never the same, because you cannot discount deferred tax assets, and your liability is on a discounted basis, so it can't be the same. Well, I've spent quite some time in the global insurance industry over the last 30 years, and I have never seen that product. Maybe it is there. Future profits of contracts which are not yet on your books.
So to what conclusion does this lead?
We think it's possible to apply mirroring starting from the liabilities and address the vast majority of the contracts. The advantage is you have one measurement basis for all contracts. The few exceptions which might then still be there maybe should be fleshed out. Final comment.
Flushed out or flushed out?
Maybe both. Final comment, as Roger already said, there is a link to the response from question 4 on how to fit this all together with OCI. EFRAG has become aware of an alternative approach, as we've called it in our paper. We are looking at it, discussing it, and see whether it can address some or parts or maybe a lot of these issues, both in question 2 and question 4.
I think it's fair to say that question 2, question 4, and actually question 1 need to be looked at together. I don't think you can consider them in isolation. The deferred tax asset, I think, is a symptom of what is very common, is that the insurance contract liability is linked to the surplus of an entity. And the surplus of an entity may include things such as deferred tax assets. So I think it's probably a little simplistic to go straight to the deferred tax asset. I think with the concern around the two measurement bases, it depends on whether you focus on the liability itself or the financial statements as a whole. So to take a simple example, if you buy an asset at 100 and the liability is to pass the whole of that 100 through to the policyholder, then 100 minus 100 is zero. Now, if the value of the asset changes to 120, and so the liability changes to 120 on the measurement basis and a current measurement basis, but you keep the asset at a cost basis, it's only 100, you're suddenly showing equity of minus 20, which is not a reflection of what's actually happened. And it's looking at the equity as a whole that we're trying to fix with the mirroring proposals. So whether you think of it as two measurement basis really does kind of depend on whether you're looking at assets and liabilities independently or whether you're looking on the combined effect. We hear a lot about the need to have different accounting to fit the different business models of different insurers. And, you know, on the face of it, there's an attraction of that. But our problem really has been, and our challenge has been, is that when we actually try and drill down into working out what the different business models of the insurers really are, we find often that it's the way the assets are held, how they have traditionally held the assets, what assets they choose to hold. And that, of course, is a matter of IFRS 9 accounting and not accounting for the insurance contract itself.
Hans, could you tell us a bit more about your alternative model which you're developing?
First, it is not a model we are developing. It is developed by others. But when we were made aware of it, we found a number of components assessed it in first instance appealing enough to do some further work on it. But we also identified some potential issues. That's why we decided, okay, we're going to add it as an appendix to our draft comment letter, ask some specific questions about that alternative model, and include a list of 6, 7, 8 items, which is on our own homework list. There are some areas where it seems that it can address a number of the issues around participating contracts, but it also raises some issues like, do you need shadow accounting? What about recycling? Do you recycle the full amount? And how does it work together with that's in OCI, that's in P&L? So we haven't taken any position on that yet, but as I said, we found it attractive enough to say, let's open the discussion up and see whether we can get additional input while at the same time working with our own staff, but also with our insurance accounting working group, which I think is going to discuss components of that model for the third or the fifth time in its next meeting in the beginning of October.
How long do you think they'll take?
Sorry, how long?
How long do you think they'll take to come up with an answer, a workable answer?
Well, you have a deadline for the final comment letter, and we try to respect that and stick as close to it as possible. And if we don't know all the answers yet, we might have shared homework.
Igor?
Okay. My comment is so simple. I talked with insurance people following this project for 10 years. He said mirroring requirement is not clear, so we don't think we have the base to comment on So much clarity is needed for scope and accounting treatment. I generally am supportive of having this kind of treatment for solving accounting mismatch, but current description is so incomplete to comment on.
Clement?
Thank you. Mirroring approach, two things. Definitely we share the comment of Hans about the if it is going to be adopted, it should be starting from the liability side, as that is how usually insurance business is managed. And second comment is on the exemption requirement right now, very overly restrictive, and we urge the board to try to look at it from the angle of whether you can, you know, sort of revert it in a more sort of principle based. And you know, at the moment, the requirement is very, very prescriptive.
Kevin?
I think the way Andrea introduced it is exactly where the discussion has been in Australia. Rather like the idea, but
yep,
the further we thought about it, the more exceptions and problems that we could come to. And I guess my only question about it is, instead of thinking of it as the way to do it, it does seem to fit in some circumstances. And so what's the principle we're really going for? Are we starting off with the principle that accounting assets are measured in various ways, hopelessly, and therefore we're going to fix the liability to whatever that number is? Is that really what's driving us, or should we be driven by the fact that sometimes assets will be measured in more realistic ways, which will help you measure the liability, because the liability there is actually to return the returns on the assets? Not all liabilities are expressed that way. So I'm just, the bits we like about it, how do we capture those in a more principled way?
I mean, I guess I would say that the general principle in the standard is that we're trying to get at a current value measurement of the insurance contract, and that's always been a principle for the board since the beginning of this project. I see the mirroring proposals as very much an exception, which is trying to target a particular problem, which occurs in a particular situation. And the problem with exceptions as a rule is that you need to have rules-based criteria for when they apply and when they don't apply, because otherwise everyone can use the exception and it becomes difficult. So I'm not surprised people are having difficulty with where we've drawn the line, because wherever we draw the line, there will always be something just on the other side. And the only way not to do that is not to have an exception. However, I'm hearing in the room that there is some sort of desire to have an exception, but just to be a better one than we've got here. And I think that really is the challenge to us. If we stick with the principle is that we're trying to get no accounting mismatch when there's no possibility of economic mismatch, how else can we achieve it? Should we actually be trying instead to get no accounting mismatch when there's no likelihood of economic mismatch, for example, or no probability of economic mismatch or any other bar? What is the principle for this exception, if you want to call it that, that we ought to be trying to get? And I think if we understand that, then as staff and then later as the board, we'll be in a better position to work out whether we have this exception at all, or whether we try and craft it in a way that meets a greater need, or perhaps restrict it so that it doesn't apply so widely, so there's less confusion, so perhaps only to effectively separate accounts or unit linked. So there's a number of ways the board could go there. It's far from clear to me at this time where we could go based on the outreach we've got so far. But I think understanding the motivations would be very important for us.
Kim?
Isn't the driver similar to the mismatch we have in financial instruments and therefore the need for hedge accounting? So again, having a mixed measurement basis. So just supposed to put it out there to say, isn't there any scope for, you know, basing it again on risk management, which hopefully would then address the concerns around saying, well, even if contractually I'm not required to hold the underlying, but economically I have invested, and as a result of that I don't have a mismatch?
One guarantee for never getting this project done is if we are going to put on top of insurance accounting and insurance specific hedge accounting model. So I don't want to go there at all, and I would rather have a crude
I think Kim's got something going. You just designate the non-financial assets and so on. There's a hedge of the movement in the liability. You're there.
Change the value of the underlying.
Well, I guess one thing is that in our 2010 proposals, we had everything through profit and loss, so this problem just effectively didn't really arise to a great extent. And this is a point I think that Hans was alluding to, that there are a limited number of assets which cannot be measured at fair value through profit and loss using fair value options that exist within IFRS at the moment. The feedback we got in 2010 was that wasn't going to work. So I see the mirror exception as trying to sort of claw back some of that elimination of mismatch that we had and had to give up in a way. And so it is a rules-based exception, and it's because of how we got there.
Diesel.
Relatively briefly, I think it's on a possibly too abstract level, but seeing this mirroring as an exception does not really do justice to how many insurance companies see the way they manage, because they manage actively coming from the asset side, and somehow pushing them all into the other direction and then call it an exception. This exception is bound to be more or less like a straitjacket for some. I haven't got the solution either, that's for sure. And as Roger already said, it might be that once and for all we need to have a number of options in there, because having the business model for all insurance companies where the products are driven by tradition, environment, including tax incentives or goodness what, is going to be extremely difficult.
Driving a business model from the asset side in a low interest environment may not be all that easy these days. I mean, I just want to mention that that how people see their business model is not always the same as the economic reality.
Not very appealing.
I mean,
but real.
It's in the guy from PIMCO, Bill. The CEO of PIMCO,
Bill Gross.
He said in an interview that because of this low interest rate environment, the business models of insurers and other sectors of the economy are simply being destroyed. So to rely on a business model as the basis of accounting is very dangerous.
On the other hand, if it's a bad model, wouldn't you want to see that? If it's a bad model, wouldn't you want to see that?
Yes, that's what I hope that we do with our that we will achieve with our with our standards. Hans?
There was a comment that insurance business model is asset driven. I'm not so sure about that, because we also heard a lot, certainly for life insurance with their long term business, that it is liability driven. The first thing they do is they sell an insurance contract. And if that's participating and has long term and has risk and therefore interest risk and all type of other risk, they look for the assets to cover the risk. And if the assets are not there, they try to combine assets with derivatives and other stuff. After a certain development period, when they are mature, things start to go a little bit on their own. But for participating contracts, the communication to the policyholder is always based on the fair value of the underlying asset. And one of the examples I've given in our discussion, then I've got 1,000 contracts, and the total fair value, if I add up all those statements, is 10 million, and the balance sheet says 6 million, because it's an amortized cost. Which one is wrong?
I suppose that's a rhetorical question.
If you would take that as a message or a conclusion, I think we're not unhappy.
Roger.
I just wanted to agree with Kim on her
hedge accounting analysis.
Oh dear.
I mean, now we're saying, what do our risk management systems, what does our risk strategy do? Now, if the risk strategy takes you to exactly hedge an insurance liability, I'm not sure why economically it's different to being contractually required to do that. And in the middle, I also wanted to talk about regulatory pressures. You may not have a contract which makes you hold these assets, but your regulator may well have a good go at you if you don't. So you can effectively have constructive requirements to hold these things, even if you don't actually have any legal ones. And I don't think this current exception model adequately addresses that.
Well, our intention was that the terms of the contract include those imputed in the contract by regulation as well, so it ought to encompass the situation you're describing.
But that's a legal contract.
A legal contract, but because of the regulation, then the legal contract has to behave in a particular way.
Well, it's only a practical expedient. It wouldn't legally make you do that. Anyway, that's probably detailed, but it's much wider than a contract.
It's a bit like economic compulsion.
Yeah. Bing, and then I would like to ask our board members if they have any views on the discussion thus far. Bing.
Okay. Actually, we would like to share some preliminary observation with the board and others. For the mirroring issue, most of the insurance company from mainland China actually generally support the proposal. I would like to remind the board is they are supporting the proposal as a package, not any single. They support it as a package. For example, particularly in this issue, the concerns whether the participating insurance contract is a part of the exception, is within the scope of the exception, whether it's a part of the so-called link, because under very strict supervision, the asset structure of insurance companies are quite very simple. Most of them are bonds and other debt investment instruments like this. So they don't care other perspective of this issue. They always ask us whether participating can be regarded as a kind of linked instrument to fulfill the conditions of the exception. Our answer is very doubtful. And I think further clarification by an informal further clarification by the staff or the team is will be helpful. And I mean in Shanghai. Okay, that's all.
Thank you. Yeah.
I think Andrea teed up when she started her discussion just some of the issues that we've been hearing and made it clear that we've heard a lot of concerns around this particular proposal. I think it's also worth saying that we've heard concerns going in two directions. Some people don't like it and want us to get rid of it. Some people want us to make it wider so they can use it more. So there's an element of the two different directions going in there. I think Andrew also mentioned that you can't really think about this issue, and Kevin, I think it was your point as well, you can't really think about this issue without also thinking about the OCI issue. And in essence, and it sort of comes back a little bit to Kim's point, if I start thinking about what I would achieve through a hedging process, under a hedging process, I'd say I fair value my assets, I fair value my liabilities, and the difference between the fair value is my ineffectiveness that goes through the income statement. And that, in essence, is the other side of the OCI choice. So it's possible that you get to a kind of hedging outset, if you like, without never having to go through the pain of all the stuff that we've got with hedging. But it does suggest that at least a part of the thought process around mirroring will come from our thought process about OCI and whether fair value, or current value, is actually an acceptable answer. Because if it is, and I think, Roger, that was where you were going to, if that is allowed as an option, it might resolve many of the concerns people have about mirroring and perhaps mean that mirroring can then become an option in certain circumstances for people to consider only when it creates a problem that's not resolved by the fair value. So maybe somewhere in that sort of part of the discussion is where the solution lies. But now I'm probably setting strategy on my feet. But certainly in terms of what I would take away from the conversation would lie somewhere along there. And just to come back to the hedging thing, I think hedging potentially does provide a solution. But to me, it feels like it's hopelessly over-engineered for what we're trying to achieve. Hedging just requires so many other things to be in place and I'm not sure that would be the appropriate solution here.
Sounds to me you're sure it's not the appropriate solution.
I was agreeing with Daryl that when Kim was making her comment, I was thinking she was going to say fair value option at the end, because I think of the linkage as being quite similar to the fair value option based on accounting mismatches.
Yeah, I guess I was using the word hedging
broadly,
not necessarily.
Exactly. And I think everybody thinks hedge accounting.
Yeah, no, but I guess to try and reflect that relationship there.
Yeah, exactly. So I would think of it more generally like the fair value option with the accounting mismatch. But again, that has a P&L implication that comes with it.
But so does hedging.
And I guess a question, but one of the questions which Daryl touched on really is, if we had a fair value option which achieves your hedging approach, is mirroring necessary? Because it does add a significant amount of complexity in the proposals and in the model. And if it's not something that people are going to use because they're simple ways to deal with their problems, do we really want it in there?
So you'd use that, you'd achieve the address the mismatch, but rather by having like an extended fair value option.
Yeah.
So if you had assets that weren't otherwise going to be measured at fair value, associated with insurance,
that you could just fair value those.
Yeah.
I'm getting confused here. Is this again an alternative to what Daryl?
It's got relation. It's, well, Daryl's is. I think, like mine, emergent thoughts at best.
It's
Hans, I think we're trying.
Hans's approach of going the other direction.
I think what we're seeing is that what mirroring is trying to address is mismatch, and because we've teed it up as an exception, it's a limited addressing of some mismatches, not all the mismatches that exist. And the interest around the room seems to be about whether there could be other approaches to address mismatch, and a fair value option could be one of those ways that addresses many of those mismatches. If that is the case, do we actually need mirroring?
Yeah. Hans?
We have had some discussion about fair value option, but we didn't pursue it further because we didn't know where to start. IFRS 9 is not yet stable. So once you know what your measurement model and income recognition model for your assets are, and let me limit it in the discussion to financial assets, in IFRS 9 and 39, there's a fair value option to avoid accounting mismatches. But okay, do you need another one then in the new insurance contract standard? And when is that triggered? Or do you need to apply both? And if fair value might address the balance sheet issue, but do you then need fair value option to P&L and fair value option to OCI? Too much interlinkage at this point in time, too little stability also in the tentative conclusions also from this board on what about OCI, question 4. So yes, we have it on the list. It may fit in. It's on the homework list, but how to exactly fit it in? But intuitively, we say it should be something which can help to avoid financial reporting which does not reflect what you expected to report, which means accounting mismatch and accounting volatility. But where to put what exactly, we haven't finalized our analysis yet.
But I do not recall that we have active discussions in IFRS 9 on fair value options, do we?
We will have. Well, at the moment, it's on the agenda.
Something to look forward to. What we're thinking.
IFRS 9 at the moment does allow you to have a fair value option to P&L for accounting mismatches, but I think Hans's point's a fair one in the sense that to get there, you'd need to have the insurance liability going fair value through P&L, and at the moment in the ED, it doesn't do that. So there's a sort of a disconnect. But I guess in the feedback that we get, we'd be interested in knowing whether if that combination would be something that you think would be a good combination, because then we can look at it in the context of the projects.
Okay, but then it would come from the direction of insurance rather than the IFRS 9 in itself.
Well, then IFRS 9 would let you do it because it has a fair value option. No. But I guess the question for me would be whether there'd be appetite or whether there'd be support, enough support for that, the economic mismatches then being in P&L. because people's view of what's an accounting mismatch and what's an economic mismatch, I think, might not always be in sync.
Kevin? We're probably preempting something that Andrew's going to ask, but I mean, our practice is to require fair value on both the asset and liability side, so the ineffectiveness is seen immediately in the income statement, and our insurers manage that way. And for me, it's a bit hard to comprehend when you're virtually forced into valuing your liabilities in current value terms to have anything that's meaningful, why you would want to record your assets at anything other than fair value, or commensurate current value if you want to be less prescriptive about it. So, you know where we would stand, and nine isn't the answer because isn't the whole answer, because we would need that option across the whole business.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not just financial.
Yeah. Russ?
What I hear you saying as a potential alternative is to measure the liability like all other insurance contracts and then remeasure the asset. If you did that, how would you deal with OCI and unlocking of the margin?
I think with OCI, you wouldn't measure the liability through OCI. It would have to go through P&L as well. Unlocking the margin does cause another mismatch, yes. We haven't dealt with that yet. We haven't thought that through.
So if what you're trying to avoid is having to have different accounting for certain types of insurance contracts, if some go to OCI and some don't, you'll have different accounting, and Stephen will raise that none of it should go to OCI. Right, Stephen?
And Pat will say it all if you go to LCI.
But then Sue will see that Pat is clear.
Hans, can I make one observation? The conversation and the comments from Hans in particular underscore for me the importance of the understanding that any principles that we create here in the area of insurance accounting should be aligned and should be contemplated and developed simultaneously with the accounting for the assets that fund insurance contracts. So one of the challenges that the board has had for a while is developing these projects on perhaps somewhat parallel paths, but at different timelines, and they've been out of sync. And as Hans astutely observed, insurance companies originate contracts, they look at the withdrawal characteristics of those contracts, their asset liability management needs, and they go out and they look for pools of assets to match those needs. So if you're trying to set a set of accounting standards that are going to meet the needs of readers of financial statements for insurance companies, those principles should be aligned. And when you create mixed measurement attribute models for the two, assets and liabilities, they're never going to be aligned. So I think we should at least sit back and figure out how we might do that, irrespective of the ideas that Daryl expressed or Steve's expressed or Andrea. It really doesn't matter. That issue is something we can deal with later. I think the key takeaway I get from this conversation is you have to do that at the same time. Otherwise, you're going to continue to create these problems, and you'll have to deal with them again in another year or two when you finalize the project and you see they're still out of line.
But Pat, I wasn't aware you have a project on IAS 16, to put it that briefly. I mean, it's not just financial instruments, it's all assets.
It's all assets.
I don't disagree, but you know, we're talking principally about investment assets, financial assets, they're backing financial liabilities.
I would say principally maybe, but there are loads of non-financial assets there too.
Backing liabilities.
Well, the home office building is not creating the volatility in reported financial results of insurance companies.
You cut Hans's argument a little short, because Hans said once the company got mature, then the asset liability management shifts around a bit, and that's when you'll get assets like office buildings and the like.
I think one of the things I've seen in the outreach so far is that one of the challenges we face really is that it really depends on what is normal in the local jurisdiction, local practice, local product. Because in many cases, the insurance liability is almost wholly backed with financial assets, and that's pretty normal. And so people in those jurisdictions, can't really see the problem because they've got a wide availability of long-dated liability of assets. Their liabilities aren't as long as all that, and so it's okay. However, when you've got very long-dated liabilities and there are no durations that match that, then they start looking at infrastructure projects, windmill farms, that sort of thing as well. And then that becomes more of a challenge. And for those companies, then it's much bigger deal than it is for the vast majority. And so you get this effect where you have a big issue for some that is generally fine for others. And it's us trying to work out where the happy medium is, where we take into account of the sum as well as the many, that I think generates a lot of the debate we've had, and that's what's made this project so difficult to bring to a conclusion.
Listen, also, if we're going to wait till we have all the accounting mismatches between assets and the liabilities fixed, we're never going to finish this.
That's right. Yeah, I agree.
We're not going to do so. We have lived with IAS 39, which is full of accounting mismatches for many years. IFRS 9 will continue to have accounting mismatches there only. The only way to resolve this is to go to full fair value. Everybody tells us that cannot be done. So at a certain point, we have to live with certain less imperfections in our accounting and live with the consequences. We have been going at insurance contracts for 10 years. It would be my ambition that we're going to finish it, and soon, because everything is better than what we have now. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a model that in broad terms has been developed in a very good way and will solve remaining issues, not completely, but if we solve them 80% of the way, we'll have done a good job. But leaving everything open till everything is calibrated is not going to lead to any decision making. At a certain point, you have to make decisions and adjust the rest.
I don't disagree with you, Hans, but the way I was going to respond to Pat's commentary is really to inject the question of time. I think you're absolutely right, and I think that generally in accounting, that sorting out how you measure assets and liabilities is pretty fundamental, but we keep cycling away from it, or recycling away from it. But we are in a situation, and I think Andrea captured it in the very beginning, where we're going from next to nothing in some countries to quite sophisticated in other countries, and we're trying to get to something that makes the world look a lot better on insurance. And that's why I think a fair value option is one way of allowing those who are ahead of the central tendency, wherever you're going to put that, not to have to go backwards, whilst allowing the others to catch up. I think it would be, if the answer was we've got to all do it the same, but all of those who are in the top 20% have to come back to the pack, you'll get extreme ridicule from our part of the world, at least, and I suspect from what Roger and others have said, from them too. So fair value, or current to current, is the way the industry would think about it, can be done, is done, has chosen to be done. So it's not the same as the general
argument. More, Ian has told me many times how when current was introduced in Australia, the insurers all predicted they would disappear. They took the account extended set to court, and now they love it.
Well,
the only constant is people don't like change.
Yeah. Ian and I went to a meeting that standard setters very rarely went to. You know, 20 odd years on from that court case, the company involved said directly to us, we were wrong and you were right, and we've come along the journey.
But I think with the accounting mismatch option that we already have in IFRS 9, which I don't see us changing as part of the deliberations, we're just going to confirm the scope of it, we have the potential to get the interaction to work with the insurance project. So I don't think it's closed. It's just that we'll need to look at that interaction as we close insurance. And in particular, if the idea is that you could sort of switch on fair value through P&L for the liabilities and the asset to confirm that you can have a sort of double election to get it to work, if you like.
Or you could change the default category as well. That would be the other way of doing it. I also wanted to come back to one of Russ's points about how the mismatch would work with the unlocking. And I wonder whether it's actually okay, because we unlock for cash flows that relate to future service, and we've said that asset returns are not a service, so the ones which should match won't be affected by the unlocking. It was just a thought.
Okay.
But anyway, let's take Hans's call of progress, not perfection, and move on. Okay, so the next topic I want to discuss is the question of insurance contract revenue and expense. And the question really here responds to the feedback we had in the 2010 exposure draft, where we had proposed a net margin presentation in the Statement of Comprehensive Income. And everyone told us that, well, a lot of people told us, shall we say, that gross performance information, volume information would provide more useful information, not disagreeing that the margin information was useful, but just that it was needed in addition. And so the challenge which really faced the board then was, well, if gross performance information is useful, then what should that be? Should it be consistent with revenue and expense for other types of transactions with customers? And the board's feeling on this is, yes, it would be better if it was consistent with revenue. And in fact, showing a large top-line number which was not consistent with revenue is very misleading. So I think this is the topic by which I've seen the most evolution in the outreach. It started off with, this is a synthetic number which is complete nonsense and has no actual inherent meaning. And it's moved through that to, well, maybe it's got some sort of conceptual justification. I can see the similarities with the proposals in the revenue project, but it's very, very difficult to do, and it's not reasonable to expect people to do that. And since that time, we've kind of explored what the drivers of the complexity are, and I think many people are now in a place where they say, well, actually, the information is not that difficult to produce, because after all, it comes from the measurement of the liability, and you're going to need most of this information to provide your footnote disclosure, so it cannot possibly be an unreasonable additional request to do. So now the debate has swung back to, okay, so this is conceptually okay, it's not too difficult to do. It might provide useful information, but will anyone actually use it? Is it actually going to be useful information? And that is a debate which is difficult to gauge, I think, from where we're sitting today, because if you ask any sort of user or analyst whether they use this information, they'll say no because they don't have the information, and it's difficult to tell how much they will use it once they get it and once it's built up some trend data and people understand what governs it. And so I think that is going to be the challenge for the board. I think in terms of what the revenue proposals look like, I don't think that's going to change too much. The question will really be, do we want it or don't we? Slide 19 shows what we think the revenue information represents. And I think this comes back down to the pricing, and it's why it's in some ways consistent with what people tend to think of as revenue. It's what you've charged the policyholder for the expenses and claims you expected to incur in the period. So it's what you expected in terms of your costs of goods sold, so to speak. It's what you expected to, what you charge your policyholder for the amount of risk you expected to bear, another factor into the cost of goods sold equation. And then it's the profit margin you charge on top of that, on top of those two components. And we think that that's very consistent with our thinking in the revenue recognition proposal. Because people are questioning the usefulness of this information, I'm going to skip past slide 20 and move on to 21, and just spend a little bit of time talking about what I think this number represents. So at the moment, the general feeling was it's quite difficult to take premium information and assign it to periods across an insurance contract. And people deal with this in different ways. They either deal with a written premium type approach, which is very common in parts of Europe, where if you write a five-year contract, you take all the premiums for that 5 year and recognise it in your top line for this year, or to take a premiums due approach, in which case you do it as it's billed. So if you have a 5 year premium and a 5 year contract and you charge premiums at the beginning of each year, then you would take an equal amount of premium each year. And this slide shows a level premium term life contract, a fairly straightforward contract. And what we think is happening is that we've got insurance contract revenue that rises over time. And what we think that depicts is that in the beginning, in the early years, the risk is lower than it is in the later years. And because you're charging a level premium, in effect, you're overcharging for the risk and building up a prepayment to fund the premiums for later years when you're charging less than the risk might suggest. And so we think that this increasing insurance contract revenue trend provides information about about the consideration that was charged for that period's cover. If you look at a slightly more, if you look at a slightly more complicated contract, you would have, for example, a deposit component in the level premium term life contract, and you would see a very different revenue pattern. You would still see the same premiums due and premiums written information because that information doesn't change, it's just what you charge each year. But in one which is funded by a deposit, what you get is a tailing insurance contract revenue because the deposit effectively funds the claims and expenses payments. Some of you have seen that slide before. Apologies to those who haven't. But what we're saying then is that the economics of the contract drive the revenue pattern, and that gives you different information from just looking at what you billed or what you wrote in the period. So that's what we think it means. As I say, this is one that people have been evolving their points of view, so I'd be interested to hear where you are or whether you have evolved even further, perhaps into a completely different direction.
We are not necessarily looking for completely different directions, but...
A timely reminder.
Roger?
I think this is a reasonable direction, and I don't really have any comments.
Hans?
We're still trying to find out where we are.
You've seen this four times.
This is a question where we have not given any tentative view. We have listed the number of advantages or disadvantages. Are working with our constituents, as I said earlier, together with national standard setters and with ISB staff to find out, for instance, whether or not the segregation of the investment component, the amount of the premiums which you certainly have had paid back, I understand it's looking backwards, is that easy, is that complex, what's the cost-benefit balance, complexity, but in our insurance accounting working group, the views have been different and are still different. We have a view, a very focused supporter of summarized margin approach. We have a view, very focused supporters of don't change anything, and there's a group in the middle. There is recognition that even if you would maintain the traditional model, summarized margin information is vital to understand the drivers of the profit. So that group says, okay, it should be presented, but then somewhere in the notes to understand it better. So we're asking the help of our constituents, our national standard setters, and our companies to find out what the tentative position or the final position of FESFAC will be. We had one debate about a perceived advantage, comparability. Where, now looking at my own notes now, it increases comparability between insurers, other deposit-taking institutions, and entity in other industries. Part of the debate was how realistic that last component is, because at least so far, all non-insurance analysts run away if they're dealing with insurance companies. Some of us had to doubt whether or not that will continue to be the case if revenue is aligned, because there are, as has been said before, a lot of other complexities still involved in accounting for insurance contracts, let alone for insurance companies. So whether that's really the main argument, we're not sure.
I think you should also clarify, Hans, that you said that the summarized margin information should be in the notes, and in fact in our proposals they are in the notes, so that is still there.
Russ?
I think the model is appropriate, although the initial feedback we got from one of the large life insurers is that they would support premiums due, which is consistent with what they do today. With respect to the P&C, they support a different approach, most like what you have today in U.S. GAAP.
How far do you think you're talking about the UPR? For the P&C, how different do you think that is from this?
I don't think it's all that different from revenue. I think the liability measurement and discounting is substantially different.
Any other comments? Was this your last issue, Andrea? Or?
No, this is only number three, I think.
Oh, okay.
We haven't done the dossier yet.
I was getting worried. No, just in terms of timing. So.
Will be
all right, go, okay. Go on.
All right, so the fourth issue, and we've already touched on many of the issues relating to this, so perhaps I can hope that this won't take so long, is to do with the determination of interest expense. And the problem we were trying to fix here is, should companies be required to provide some sort of separation of results between the underwriting and investment type activities, which people see as part of the thing that the management of insurance companies should be looking at, and the changes in discount rates, which they see as somehow a different sort of qualitative information, quality of information. And our proposal on slide 24 is to subdivide the statement of total comprehensive income into a profit and loss section, which includes interest expense based on a sort of amortized cost locked in type of view of the time value of money, and the effect of discount rate changes on the insurance liability in total comprehensive income. And that reflects our view that there is useful information to be had by this aggregation, and that separating it outside profit or loss makes that difference very clear. On slide 26, we have obviously heard in this room a call for an OCI option, and I hear that a lot as we do outreach, and I think it's fair to say it's something that the board is going to debate in a fairly extensive way. But there's some information I think we are really looking for in the comment letters on that, and that's how would you actually make an OCI option work? Because I think it's important to remember that the board did consider an option when it came up with the proposals in the exposure draft, and it rejected it for a number of reasons. Now, I think there's at least three, possibly more, and that different members put different weight on different reasons, as we always say. One is comparability. If you say that this aggregation is so important that it must be done outside profit or loss, how do you then say it's okay for some not to do it? So what do we do with the comparability of financial statements? How would an option help comparability? Another question is, how much complexity is there in specifying when an option could apply? I think part of the reason the board rejected an OCI option, and we have board members all around me who could possibly comment themselves, but part of the reason was they perceived an option as adding an extra layer of complexity on an already complex standard. And answering, dealing with an option requires us to answer questions about what is the best unit of account to apply. What happens when there is an expected accounting mismatch, but if the assets over time change so that the mismatch is not what you originally expected, but could be in a completely different direction? What do you do about sort of opportunistic election of the option, and so on and so forth? So I think in terms of the comment letters, it would help us a lot if we could understand how we could make any such option operational.
Linda?
So I would characterize this as probably the single biggest issue that we will wrestle with. Our feedback from our task force has been that they feel that an OCI option would alleviate many, not all, but many of the issues that we're facing. We debated this, actually. We spent 2.5-3 hours at the last Accounting Standards Board in Canada talking about insurance, and one of the things that we did, because we have board members who come from very differing backgrounds and are not often exposed to the insurance accounting, we actually took the opportunity to do, certainly for the first time in my tenure, not tenure as chair, but tenure as a board member, we did an education session where we worked through what the outcomes would be. And so I think that while we actually agree with some of the drawbacks that are listed here on slide 26, and Andrea has been great about listening to the discussions in the task force, so she's well acquainted with them, I think we would strongly support an OCI option from the standpoint of, because the life business in Canada is extremely long duration, they feel that that would help them in dealing with some of the accounting mismatches and the volatility that they feel would affect their capital levels. And while I realize that as a standard setter, it's not our job to fix regulatory capital issues, we can't necessarily ignore them. So I think in this particular situation, will likely be coming back in our comment letter strongly supporting an OCI option.
Would you also have potential solutions to the issues that Andrea
right,
raised?
So thanks, Pat. What we are actually working through now with the task force is things like how would we deal with these issues? Would we recommend different kinds of disclosures? What would we do? Because I think the task force, the insurance company members of the task force are seeing perhaps why you have your position relative to the current proposal, and so they're coming back trying to suggest alternatives, and so we will make every attempt to include those in an appendix to the comment letter.
And what's the unit of account? What is the unit of account that they're proposing?
We think at a portfolio level. Portfolio is still being discussed. Mm-hmm. How do you define the portfolio?
And discipline?
Hmm?
And Andrea made clear that we would be looking for ways to discipline.
Absolutely. But frankly, I have to say that in the Canadian environment with certification requirements and the way we approach things, I think that's part of our culture, so I think we can deal with that.
Yeah, we also had some discussion about the word discipline, as you call it, in the sense that we don't fully support the proposals. We have some alternative ideas, but the alternative ideas should not be an unrestricted or unlimited option. We align our proposals to what we call active asset liability management. And if that is a driver in our proposals, it needs to meet a number of conditions. It needs to be observable, needs to be documented. Who mentioned hedge accounting earlier? There are some similarities there, but we're not yet sure whether we can put our proposal to, on the one hand, avoid short-term volatility in the profit or loss account by making use of OCI for liability movements as well as asset movements, whether we can sufficiently make it operational. So we have a number of specific questions out to constituents saying, what's the balance between operationality, complexity, understandability? We have a question out, and as soon as this letter was on our website, I started to receive emails from members of our insurance accounting work group from the UK environment and the Scandinavian accounting. Where is fair value to profit and loss? We need that. And EFRAG now says it's fair value to OCI and nothing else. Hold on. We discussed it. And we're doing some research. So help us in that area. And I'll be in London in 2 weeks, an insurance conference, so I'm starting to prepare myself for this type of feedback. On the other hand, we have found Pat's contribution, the long and winding road, where there is a discussion about if it's all fair value in profit or loss, investors will ask for a split in the stable component and the changes in the discount rate anyway. So the moment we have a position, fair value to OCI, but we may partly come back to it when we know more. And the discussion we have had, without conclusions yet, is the same as what Linda mentioned. See what's the link with asset liability management and portfolios. Because that may be a solution. The minor comment, we are looking at from both ways in our next insurance accounting work meeting. What if the default would be fair value to P&L? How and when can you get to fair value to OCI? Mm-hmm. And the other way around. Whether we find an answer already, I don't know.
I think Hans raises a good point, which I'd like to come back on to before, if you don't mind. And that is, the outreach we've done with users suggests that there is support for a disaggregation within profit and loss if we were to put everything within profit and loss. They're interested in the two components of information, not so much where it actually is. And then, of course, if the reason we're trying to allow a fair value option is to avoid the complexity involved in making that disaggregation, then we either don't meet the needs of those people who want the disaggregation, or we need to meet it in a different way, which is perhaps less complex. And that is something that I think would be usefully picked up as well in the comment letters.
Clemens?
Thank you. As I said at the outset, our insurance work group, unlike our Canadian friends, they're having a grave concern on the option of having this OCI option. And I think the main concern is about, you know, the comparability and also the split between P&L and OCI seems to be very complex and it's very difficult to explain. Very similar to the European group concern.
Kevin?
I guess our industry has been probably the most supportive from the earliest point of the whole project, and generally so we really want to say, yes, ISB, go forward, we really like what you're doing, even though some of the bits and pieces don't exactly match with their first preferences. The big exception is this one. They really don't like the idea of taking interest rate changes to OCI. They believe that it will create accounting mismatches because it will separate the effects of interest rate changes from inflation changes when there tends to be an inverse relationship between those two things, and they are managed in that way, so they can't understand why you would prize it apart. They're also very concerned about...
Can you explain that, Kevin? How would inflation come into play?
Interest rates and inflation generally move inversely. So if you've got a long-tail liability, the cost of servicing that liability over time will go up with inflation, and the interest rates will go in the opposite direction on average. So they balance those things out, and separating them just gives a mismatch of what they're trying to achieve. If you do actually want to separate the OCI element, you have to think of the millions of policies that are potentially involved and how many cohorts of those you have to form to identify when they originated, what happened to interest over time, when some of them went away and others didn't go away. The tracking is actually quite enormous. So for those who have not been down this track or thought about it too much, who think it might be an answer to volatility, our contention is it will create volatility, and secondly, the physical tracking involved will be very expensive. And at the end of the day, what do you want to make out of the movement in interest rates over history? Now, the point that the industry really would strongly agree is that where you've got a movement in your current values in a period, you should be explaining what has caused that. So they're perfectly happy to decompose the movement in the insurance contract value or in asset and in assets. So they're not disagreeing with that. They just see no point in an historical number. It just doesn't relate to how they measure assets and liabilities or how they manage their business.
Kim?
Yeah, I think just to echo what Kevin has said, our industry as well is certainly not supportive at all of the OCI option, and believe everything should just go through profit or loss. There's a big concern that, yeah, there's going to be a whole bunch of other mismatches as a result of putting this in OCI. And in our industry as well, they tend to actually economically hedge the interest rate risk inherent in the insurance liability. So they see it as a real economic element, and therefore that should be in profit or loss, and they are managing it. And if they're using derivatives and whatever, those are also at fair value through profit or loss. And so not supportive of an OCI option, or... Well, maybe supportive of an option if we can get there, but certainly one profit or loss, or otherwise just profit or loss.
what I should have said is that we wouldn't be insisting that everybody goes current to current because of what I said before. There's a timing aspect. It's just not practical to push everybody to that level at this stage around the world. So we would favour a fair value option, and we would be quite happy for that to be entity-wide and irrevocable.
Okay. All right, so the last topic targeted at exposure graph deals with what happens at transition. And the challenge for first-time application is measuring the contractual service margin at the date of transition. And the question really that the board was addressing in this was, how do we balance the verifiability even of the amount recognised at the transition date with the comparability between contracts issued before and after the date of transition? In our 2010 exposure draft, our conclusion was that any sort of attempt to measure the contractual service margin would create a large amount of subjectivity which would impair comparability. And so we set it at zero, and I think that was probably, at the time, the single most unpopular decision that the board made, and this was obviously before mandatory OCI, so that's a different bar. In the new exposure draft, we have proposed that, first of all, you would apply the normal requirements of IAS 8, so you would do retrospective to the extent practicable, and when it's not practicable, because we think that that will occur in quite a lot of cases, we've provided some simplifications which will try and create an estimate of what would have been done had you done retrospective application, but with some boundaries around it in effect. And this proposal for a simplification plus a retrospective approach has been largely welcomed by almost everyone I've spoken to. I think in some of the emerging economies there are some concerns around the work that would be needed to be done to estimate it, because it does require a certain amount of looking back. I suspect it's also got a lot to do with how far people expect to have to look back, and how many different types of contracts and products they have. So on transition, the issue is not so much the proposals, but rather when. And there's two factors here. The first is that we've said that there will be a mandatory effective date approximately 3 years after we finalise the standard. And normally we would allow 12 to 18 months, but we think that in view of the pervasiveness of these proposals for the companies affected and the extent of change that would be required in some cases, that a longer implementation period is necessary. So one pushback I've heard is that 3 years is not enough. There are people that are saying 5 years might be okay. There are people saying that even if we allowed 10 years, people wouldn't start until year seven. So there's still a reasonable amount of differing views. And I think what would help us in terms of understanding those views is which product lines, what's causing the difficulty. Maybe most of them could be done within 2 years or even less, but there are probably some which have greater difficulty. And understanding that driver would be useful to us as well. There's also the question of how this interacts with the effective date of IFRS 9, and this is again one of the big issues that I hear a lot in the outreach. IFRS 9 previously said it was going to be mandatorily effective in 2015, I think it was. We've now said that it won't be 2015, but the date is yet to be determined, and there's a reasonable amount of angst about whether or not these proposals and IFRS 9 would be applied at the same time. To which I would say that it's very difficult to tell at this stage what the trajectory of both projects will be, and so I think we've heard the message, we understand the issues, it's possibly premature to come to a conclusion on that just now for us. So any other comments on the transition and application?
Roger?
Well, we think the changes in transition are excellent, so we certainly support those. I'm not sure that 3 years is not appropriate, i.e. I think that's probably enough. But it is worth saying that I think a lot of insurance companies can have to build brand new systems to match this, so we need 3 years. The other issue, I said this to Andrew before, is that I think it would be good if the draft standard could lay open for a while. I think that could even go into the three-year period. I don't need to revisit basic issues, but I think when actually people start writing the systems and get into the real detail, I think there could be a lot of minor issues And I think if we could have a staff draft for a while, so people could come back on practical implementation issues, would be helpful. And I think the current proposals, I think, are only 2 months or something, and I think that's not long enough.
It's a real danger in doing that, though, Roger, that all sorts of issues get reopened. I mean, we've just had a bad experience with another standard.
I'm not suggesting reopening basic issues, I'm just saying...
No, that's not how people see it.
Yeah, well,
very dangerous.
Well, it may be dangerous, but otherwise you're going to end up with a standard which is potentially unworkable. This is an awful lot of practical details here.
Maybe we just have to keep ourselves open to change things if they're really shown to be, you know, fallacious.
We have a plus implementation report.
In this area, from an effort perspective, we have two well done comments. First, the transition approach, and I remember I was here in this room when there was the first ISB outreach, and Warren McGregor, chairing that meeting, said, we're not going to discuss our 2010 transition proposals because we already learned that staff was right and we were wrong. But our view was, you're right this time. We also support a 3-year, and we shared our concerns about alignment of effective date of 9 and the new one, whatever the number is. However, in both cases, we feel early application should be permitted, because there are companies out there who may want to and are ready to apply one of the two. And if IFRS 9 would be applied before the new contract on assurance standard, we think some expansion, some widening of the scope of reclassification, redesignation should be permitted. It's moving in the right direction, but we think there should be a little bit more to make sure that first year an insurance company applies both standards, that you don't start with a mismatch. But there are some details still to be worked on, we think.
I think there is also the idea that for those who will apply IFRS 4, the effective date of IFRS 10 could be aligned with that of IFRS 4, which avoids getting into any form of reclassification.
Linda?
I'm happy to say that this is the one thing that our constituents agree on, that they're very happy with the change in the notion of the retrospective application, so they agree on that. There is some discussion about the amount of time needed, so Andrea is piping in on that quite nicely. We had a discussion around whether it was 3 years or 4 years. One of the things, though, when I pushed back on that a little bit, I said, well, if you really are taking the view that you want IFRS 9 and this change to come at the same time, then you need to get ready perhaps to do whatever you need to do in the amount of time that will make that happen. One of the things, we would also support having either standard or pieces to be early adopted. There are folks wanting to do that. One of the complexities we've started to consider as a board is this is a proposal for insurance contracts, not insurance companies. So, for instance, if you're a big bank, and there are 5 of them who have insurance contracts, we wouldn't want to necessarily have them go IFRS 9 for the rest of their portfolios and then bring in insurance contracts for some sort of policy issue if they were not effective on the same dates.
Okay.
You see, Andrea, it's really quite simple. It's a matter of being lenient.
We'll become very happy.
I guess it's just the question hands. I mean, if 9 is finished, there are other pressures on you, obviously, for 9, and who wants access to that early? If it's available and it has a much wider audience than the insurance standard, can you really hang off on it? Or is the answer just that you go as soon as you can, but with a very late application date, and try and make sure that insurance doesn't get beyond that date?
It's a dilemma. Mm.
No, get it.
There are 2 points. The first one is both of the users and the insurance companies think the transitional requirements proposed by the new ED is much more acceptable compared with the one proposed by the ED 2010. This is the first, the point one. And point two is the highly recommended and the board to align the mandatory effective date of IFRS 9 and these final standards. The reason is very, very interesting because nobody would like to suffer from a big change resulting from an important standard like IFRS 9 and then after another one like IFRS 4 in maybe 2 years, particularly practitioners, auditors.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, so those were the targeted areas that we had in our exposure draft. Another question for you is whether there were any burning issues that you've heard that perhaps we haven't heard of yet before. I know that there are questions around the unit of account and what that means and how it applies. I know there are questions around the contract boundary changes we made, and there's some questions around the scope as well. I don't have a note here, so I'm probably going to miss some off, but I also know that there's some remaining questions in some jurisdictions, for example, about the discount rate. What else is burning on your list of comments that I need to know about?
Sorry.
Yes, equal.
I missed a comment on the revenue and the revenue on a gross basis and the investment component. We are supportive of approach to show the revenue and on a gross basis, but the current methodology is not supported regarding the nature of insurance. Insurance is a service to cover not only the payment of insurance cost. So the current methodology to decide insurance payment of from the payment of insurance claims is not supported. So the regarding investment component, excluding the investment component from revenue, is supportive, but scope may seem to be a little bit too broad. So we think we propose the investment component to be excluded is to be an insurance contract which has explicit account balance and or which has an important investment feature regardless that FSB might change the scope.
So your question is not so much with the question of whether to exclude the deposit component from revenue, but to narrow the how we've defined the investment component, I guess. I guess the challenge for that, for us there, is that almost every user that we've spoken to agrees that the inclusion of deposits in the top line for insurance contracts is one of the flaws of insurance contract accounting and is one of the contributory factors to insurance being so difficult for people to understand. So I think that's the problem that we have around that issue.
Russ?
Defining the portfolio is challenging for a lot of U.S. Constituents. The P&C industry overall believes that they have different economics than that of life and it should be a different model. Both it appears the P&C preparers and their investors do not support discounting. They believe that it's not consistent with how they manage the business, and they don't generally do asset liability management. There is some concern about the way we have worded the measurement. They don't believe that they currently do an unbiased, probably weighted mean, and therefore be a substantial change in their calculation. A significant life insurer stakeholder group is supportive of the ISB's model for acquisition costs. As you may recall, the U.S. changed during the development of this to say that you actually had to be successful in acquiring before you could defer acquisition costs. They like the old model, which is where you would defer unsuccessful costs as an acquisition cost. And last but not least, there will be likely some implementation guidance necessary for how health insurers deal with the treatment of cost in the Affordable Care Act, sometimes known as Obamacare. That again is, of course, a U.S.-centric approach that we'll have to stand ready to help.
Okay, thanks, Roger.
Just a minor issue. Policyholders' taxes, which applies in some jurisdictions, it's not clear whether they're caught up in the liability, but also if you could resolve the income statement treatment of policyholder taxes, which at the moment go through the income tax line, it would be helpful because at the moment everyone has had a non-gap measure to pull those policyholder taxes out of the income tax line and put them up into the pre-tax line, which is where they belong.
I think that might be challenging since IS 12 isn't open.
Yeah, okay, but it's a problem.
Yeah, no, except.
Linda.
Yeah, I think that one of the things you'll hear in our letter, it will be a resounding call for a converged standard between the two boards. We are hearing from Manulife, our biggest insurance company, on October the 9th on preliminary results of the field tests they're doing with three large insurance companies. And I think, Andrea, they're trying to tee up a broader discussion of that the first week in November. But because of the timing of our board meeting, we're going to get an early read on those. So I'm sure that will make it into our comment letter.
Okay, Hans.
In an appendix to our draft comment letter, we raised a few other smaller issues. I'm going to mention three. The first two are based on the tentative feedback we have received so far, widely shared, at least in Europe. First, we still don't like the mandatory disclosure of the confidence level if there's no prescription anymore for the technique. We think it's overdone. Second, which I also get a lot of positive comment on, is we also don't like the requirement to disclose minimal capital requirements and explain in a draft comment letter that has been a heavy debate in finalizing IFRS 7. I was a member of that working group at the time, and I remember the resistance from especially a high-level European banking organization that a bank would be required to disclose its regulatory capital requirement in cases that regulator had increased above the minimum level. But the position we take here, if it is decision-useful information, why only for insurers? Then it should be an IS1 requirement, like there already is today. Third element is being brought back to our discussion table where there is a tentative position with AFLAC Tech, but not all reinsurers agree with the proposal. So we are redebating it also in our insurance accounting working group, moving to initial measurement, subsequent measurement, and based on that, we will start, we'll see how and whether, and we will bring it back to AFLAC Tech. But from a European discussion, that debate is not yet over, and I see Liesel supporting certainly that comment.
Reinsurance asset held by General Insurance.
Russ?
Hans said something, and Roger seconded, but about the disclosure of the confidence level. Why is that not an application of disclosure of an accounting policy? Meaning if you do a 90% confidence and Roger does a 98% confidence and I do an 80% confidence, you could get wide differences without anybody knowing that we have different applications of the measurement philosophies between our three organizations.
Well, once you know that, I don't know what you do with it, because if you at least on regulatory capital, everyone's working off a 1 in 200 year event, so at least you can compare. But if you're looking at different confidence levels, the information is just not comparable. So you'd have to start mandating confidence levels to make that useful.
But if you don't disclose that we have different levels of confidence, could it give the investor the view that it is comparable when it's not?
I wouldn't disclose it at all, actually, not unless you can make it consistent.
I think the concern that the board was trying to address in requiring this is because we don't specify a limited number of techniques as we previously had. And the techniques we know will produce different results depending on which technique's chosen in which circumstances. And in principle, that's no different really from a level three fair value measurement approach. But where the board saw the main distinction is that you don't have a market discipline of trying to get at what a market participant might require, because we've said it's an entity-specific degree of risk aversion. And so the purpose of the confidence level disclosure is to try and get some sort of comparability, some sort of information about how varied the entity-specific degree of risk aversion is, to avoid the situation which was often debated at board table, that a new CEO comes in, changes his degree of risk tolerance and completely changes the numbers. So it was trying to get at that the board wanted that disclosure.
Hans?
But it might even give the reader the impression that there is comparability where there's actually not. If you have a long tail risk and you convert that into a confidence level, it might come up with exactly the same percentages as a short tail risk, while the actual risk is much different. And that's why, rightly so, you ask disclosures, or you ask the description about the techniques, you have backward-looking information in claim development tables, how good were your assessment, how was your risk developed, you have descriptions of the risk and how you manage your risk. So the hesitation, the discussion we have is, this is an example of overload, which might conceptually sound attractive, but maybe even misleading.
I guess what the board was well aware of the challenges of that particular disclosure, and that it was a fairly limited, that the usefulness had some limitations. I don't think they were under any illusions that this was a magic bullet. I think that in the absence of anything better, they thought it was better than nothing. I think, you know, all the other things you described don't quite get to the nub of what they were trying to get at, and that's why it's in there.
Steve?
I wanted to ask Linda about, you mentioned field tests, and I've only had sort of various second-hand conversations about this, but my understanding is that this is all to do with the discount rate, and the tests are showing extreme volatility of liability measures. I have a lot of concern that the tests have been done on the basis of a misreading of the standard.
So I don't disagree with that. I think that I think we're keenly interested in probing quite extensively the results of the test for a couple of reasons. Number one, I will say that the four companies have gotten E&Y to be involved in the field testing, so hopefully that adds some consistency in terms of how they're approaching things. We also have a concern that they're misreading, and you know, we've spoken about that. We think they're misreading a couple of things, one having to do with how you do whether or not you do extrapolation, how you do extrapolation, et cetera. So we are concerned about that. And if that were the case, that would resolve, I think, many of the concerns if we could explore that. The other thing of interest that I probably should have said is that they are doing the field testing comparing both of the proposals. So they're doing it on the basis of the FASB proposal, they're doing it on the basis of the ISB proposal. So the U.S. companies are looking at the ISB proposal, Manulife's looking at the FASB proposal. And so that also may be enlightening in terms of my understanding is they are producing different results. I don't understand that, but my understanding is that's true. And so we hope to get an early read on those. I don't understand why, you know, the level of difference, but we hope to get a read on that, as I say, on October the 9th.
Steve, we are conducting field tests in Brazil, and this problem is quite severe because we have the maturity of the insurance liabilities, especially on life insurance, is much longer than we can actually observe rates on the market, so it's hard to extrapolate.
So what is the problem? It's determining a long-dated discount rate for the liability.
Yeah, well, you can't observe it. It's not a question of extrapolation because I don't have 2 points. No, it's really a question of forecast.
Okay, so we essentially haven't specified a method.
No, as you're saying, but it's not a question of the method. We cannot observe the rate for 30 years, for example. So I just observe for 15. From 15 to the 30 years, it's not a question of extrapolation between 2 points. It's or 3 points or something like that. It's that you don't have any data. Because okay. In emerging markets, you don't have. So insurance liabilities have the same maturity everywhere in the world. But the interest rate markets are completely different.
So what's the solution?
I don't know. just posing to you one of the difficulties that you mentioned.
Beyond the observable period, we say you should estimate the rates, level which we must have done in the pricing. So how would you have done it in the pricing?
No, but we didn't use to fair value those liabilities. No. We use flat rates, know what I mean? We just changed rates and we used a flat rate that was the current standard in Brazil.
But when the premiums are initially set,
yeah.
How does the company determine what those premiums are? Unless it has some idea
on the spot market, you don't have a term structure of it for the longer period. You know what I mean?
But say, so what spot rate would you choose?
No, I have a liquid market. I don't have any problem with the short term. The problem is in the longer term. No, I can assume that the future will behave like the present. Okay. It's one way to do this, but that's just asking, that's where the complexity lies.
So is it subjectivity of the estimate that's the problem,
yeah.
Rather than...
It's just much harder to estimate. Mm. It's something that the treasury, every treasurer has on the dealing with in emerging markets, and every time you have to hedge something, you don't have longer term rates.
It does suggest that the problem between Brazil and Canada is actually very different.
The concern was
the volatility introduced because of the potential changes. Brazil, it's more about trying to find a way to actually estimate that.
On top of that.
Once you estimate it, I would assume you wouldn't have much volatility. Yeah. Because you're looking at that long
dated. Depend on the method you use.
Because there's nothing to observe.
Yeah. You use a flat rate over a certain point. After a certain point, you use a flat rate. So the standard does not specify a method. Yeah.
Would you like us to specify a method?
you're asking about
but
complexity.
What's
not simple thing to do. No. Don't use it to do it. It's not simple. There's no.
You could also say count your blessings.
There's no recipe. Easy recipe to do this.
No better alternative.
My actuaries are not used to do it, so it's.
Please.
On a not too serious note, we should maybe one day come back to pension accounting. And
why would we want to do that?
Because it's so similar to it.
I'm glad you said it was not too serious. Okay, we finished just in time. Thank you for an interesting conversation.
Voila.
It is very clear that we still have some nuts to crack and that we will not be able to make everybody happy around the table. Also, some parties, it is not clear how they could be made happy. That is also an additional complication. But this nut will have to be cracked. Thanks a lot. I think staff appreciative of the comments that we received.
Thanks.
So is the board.
So
we resume our meeting at 9 o'clock tomorrow? Yes. Yeah?
Yeah.